JSA in the 90s. This episode, a spotlight on the holidays. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, and if my voice sounds like this, it means I either have a really bad head cold, or I've finally reached puberty. You decide. But more important to this episode, I have brought along some friends to help me celebrate the holidays. We'll speak with my second co-host a little bit later. But for now, my first co-host today is the founder and senior quizmaster of The Big Quiz Thing, a live trivia spectacular for corporate and private events. He's the former editor for Rolling Stone and Time Out New York. He's competed on Jeopardy, and he's a fellow podcaster. He's one of the hosts of I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn cast. And naturally, he's a DC Comics geek, in addition to being geeky for many, many other things, some of which I probably can't even legally say on the air. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Noah Tarnow. Welcome to the holidays of the JSA Brownstone, Noah. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. Congratulations on reaching puberty. You're a man now, Shag.
I'm very excited. I'm very, very excited.
Yes.
Oh, wow. So thank you so much for joining me in this holiday discussion. Folks, today we are going to be covering two JSA-related comics from the 1990s that were holiday-themed. Noah and I are going to talk about a comic from 1997 from the anthology comic, which was called DC Holiday Bash 2. We're covering the short story called I Left My Heart at the Justice Society Canteen. Then a little bit later, we'll get rid of Noah. Don't worry about that. And then we'll have another guest to talk about another story from 1997, which is from the Mature Readers Anthology comic called Vertigo Winter's Edge number 1. We're going to be covering a short story featuring Wesley Dodds from Sandman Mystery Theater entitled Spirit of the Season. So, Noah, thank you for being here. Are you a holidays fan or are you a Grinch?
I'm a good Jewish boy. I never celebrated Christmas. Obviously, as a kid, I loved Hanukkah because that's when I got Star Wars figures. But I'd say I like the holidays. You know, work always slows down. No matter what job I've had, it always seems to slow down. And I lived in New York for many years where the Christmas season is really kind of magical and beautiful. So, you know, I'd say I'm a holiday fan. This season of holidays, I famously among my friends, I hate Valentine's Day. I think Valentine's Day is evil. But that's not what we're talking about. So yeah, sure. I'm not a Grinch. I wouldn't call myself that.
Well, I love that I have invited you on to talk about the Christmas story and have a different guest to talk about the Hanukkah story. So I planned that well, didn't I?
What are the odds? Well, you know, when you cross cultures like this, it's good. You know, diversity is our strength.
There we go. Exactly. Yeah. So, and that, by the way, that is going to be part of my goal here is every December to do a holiday themed episode featuring comics that were published in that era. Like, you know, right now we're doing JSA in the 90s. So these are 90s ones. When we get to JSA in the 2000s, we'll do 2000s era holiday comics then. Now, Noah, this is not your first time here at the Brownstone, by the way. As you may recall, you were here back in July 2022, long before JSA in the 90s launched. What did we talk about?
We talked about the miniseries Golden Age by James Robinson and Paul Smith. Arguably, my next to Watchmen, my second favorite comic book miniseries ever.
It's so stinking good.
That was
so
a real treat. Yeah.
Stinking good. And folks, because Noah and I had an awesome conversation about it with some other folks who joined us, we won't be covering it on JSA in the 90s because it's here on this feed already. Just go back to July 2022, you can hear Noah talk about Golden Age and how much we love that miniseries. Because honestly, I still think that that is the reason we got the James Robinson JSA series, which eventually Jeff Johns took over. I have no doubt that's why we got it.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the Golden Age movie. At this point, we're ready, you know, animated or otherwise. I think it can and should happen, and I pray it does.
We're getting everything else. You know, we've got Peacemaker TV series. Why can't we have a Golden Age.
We have an excellent piece. What world do we live in? We have excellent Peacemaker TV series, you know, getting ready for its second season.
And Rocket Raccoon is a movie star. I mean, Jesus, this is not the world we would have expected when we were
universe?
Kids. Well, before we get too much further, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors, folks. This episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping of orders $50 or more. Now, each episode, we'll select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, and usually it's tied into this month's JSA, you know, topic in some way, shape, or form. I picked Wesley Dodd's The Sandman trade paperback. Now, this collects the very recent Wesley Dodd's The Sandman, issue 1 through 6 miniseries published in 2024, written by Robert Venetti, artist by Riley Rossmo. It is exceptional.
That's very good.
So if you're one of the, you know, the old curmudgeons like me that like old comics and don't like new comics, let me tell you, this one's for you, folks. Again, came out just this year. This collected edition is 136 pages. It's full color. It feels like a nice amalgam of Sandman Mystery Theater and more traditional superhero comics to me. That's how I feel about it. The art is astonishing. So obviously you read it, it sounds like, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I liked it a lot.
So stinking good. So it normally goes for $16.99, but you can get it 45% off right now. So it's only $9.34. Cannot recommend it highly enough. Wesley Dodd's The Sandman trade paperback. Now, what about you, Noah? What'd you bring today?
Well, the story we're going to look at is written by Howard Chaykin, the great Howard Chaykin. And my earliest memory of Howard Chaykin was in the late 80s, he did a Blackhawk miniseries.
Ah.
So I recommend the hardcover collection of Blackhawk Blood and Iron. I believe this was when it was established in continuity that Blackhawk was a Polish guy, Janusz Prochaska, and he's accused of communist leanings. He stumbles across a plot to overthrow the U.S. government and bomb New York City, concocted by former Nazis out for revenge. So this hardcover collects Blackhawk Blood and Iron 1 through 3, plus various issues of Action Comics Weekly and an issue of Secret Origins, written and drawn by Howard Chaykin, 384 pages, full color, hardcover, was $49.99. In-stock trades price is $28.99. You save the magical number of 42%.
You know, Blackhawk knows where their towel is, don't they?
Yes, absolutely.
That sounds like an awesome collection. And then that Action Comics Weekly stuff just is... So many people have forgotten those things even exist. So it's great that they pulled all that together. That's fantastic. Well, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. In certain tiers, you get mentioned on the show of your choice. Just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast, which means they're on Santa's nice list this year. So our thanks go out to Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, David A. Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Extremely Uncanny, George Van Note, Gort Tolton, Jason Keane, Jay Campbell, John Coos, Keechee Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Zemkowski, Roger Priebe, Russell Burbage, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. Now, folks, as I always say, this is not just my show. This is not just Noah's show. Believe me, it's definitely not Noah's show. But this is your show, too. We want you to be part of the conversation. Please go out on the social media. We're on most of the medias as JSA Presents. You can find us there. Be part of the conversation. Most importantly, go to our website and leave your comments there, because that's where we pull from primarily for the feedback. Now, the story we're going to be reading today comes from DC Holiday Bash number 2, which if you don't have a copy in your long boxes, you can get on DC Infinite and get in lots of different places. We will post a few pages up on our gallery on our website. However, it's only like 10 pages, so I'm not going to post the whole thing, folks. You got to get your hands on this thing. It's well worth it. So again, it's DC Holiday Bash number 2, published by DC Comics, cover dated. It simply says 1998, but the reality is it was on the shelves December 24th, 1997. What a great Christmas Eve present to yourself. This would have been great. Cover price is $3.95. The full book was 64 pages. Includes other stories in there, like there's a great Kyle Rayner and Connor Hawke story. Batman, Darkseid's got a hilarious story in there. That's not something you typically say, right? Black Lightning, Superman, Sergeant Rock, Nightwing and Oracle. There's even these DC hero themed ornaments that you can cut out and you can paste and things like that. It's super fun. But we're going to be talking about I Left My Heart at the Justice Society Canteen. So this 10-page story was, as Noah said, written by Howard Chaykin. He gave special thanks to a James Kelton as well. Illustrated by Rick Burchett. Amazing. Letter is John Costanza. Colorist is Rick Taylor. Editor is Darren Vincenzo. All right, I'll do a brief recap, then we're going to get into some discussion. So, while World War II rages across Europe, it's Christmas Eve in Gotham City in 1944. We're introduced to a young Navy ensign from Peoria, Illinois. He's not a war hero, he's just some guy who washes the Navy's laundry on a dry docked ship. This kid from Peoria finds his way to the hottest spot for soldiers tonight, the Justice Society canteen. As he stands in line, he's bullied by a couple of Navy officers, but Wildcat quickly steps in to sort things out. Inside, a grand holiday celebration is in full swing for the troops. Celebrity-masked men and women are everywhere. A big band is playing, heroes are serving tables, Mary, girl of a thousand gimmicks, is singing holiday tunes, and Jay Garrick is decorating the Christmas tree at super speed. In a surprising twist, Peoria wins a knot-tying competition against the Guardian, earning a dance with the stunning Black Canary. During their dance, Peoria notices the bully Navy officers again and realizes something's off. Peoria's experience with Navy laundry tells him that their uniforms are all wrong. They're imposters. These imposters have ambushed Al Pratt the Atom and have set a bomb to destroy the canteen and all of its festive goers. Peoria, with quick thinking and bravery, catches the saboteurs red-handed and gets a helping hand from Black Canary and Hourman. It's been a night of excitement, festive cheer, and unexpected heroism, making it a Christmas Eve to remember in Gotham City. As Mary, girl of a thousand gimmicks, sings the poignant Silent Night, soldiers are moved to reflect on their past and looking towards the future, with many faces damp with emotional tears. Black Canary thanks Peoria for his heroism with a heartfelt kiss, and we learn that this ensign from Peoria is none other than Jim Gordon. Woof, man.
Dun, dun, dun.
That is a lot in 10 pages. What'd you think of this, buddy?
I love this story. I think it's great. I will say that the idea of, you know, German saboteurs in the U.S., it feels like a bit of a cliche. I mean, I don't know for sure, but like, I feel like that's the standard plot of a genuine World War II era superhero story. But, you know, it's okay. They make it work.
To be fair, off the air, though, we were talking about how you just want crazy, nutsy superhero stories to be superhero stories. And that's what you got here.
Yeah, it totally is. I mean, other than that, I like everything else about this. So I totally forgive that. I start with the negative. That's my strategy in life.
Okay.
Rick Burchett is an amazing artist.
Yeah.
He gives this. I know him from he drew like the Batman Adventures, the you know, the comic book version of the Batman animated series.
Oh yeah.
So he's got that kind of semi cartoony, you know, Ty Templeton, Mike Parabek style, which works great here. And it's not too childish because he draws very sexy women.
Oof, man.
Black Canary looks great here.
Yeah, she does.
A lot of good stuff here. Here's a question. How far back was it established that the JSA was in Gotham City? Like in the 40s, were they acknowledging that they're in the same city as Batman?
Oh, see, that's a good question. I don't know as far as legitimately. I know in the retcon stories, like, you know, if you read All-Star Squadron, things like that, that was established. But I can't tell you if it was in the 40s. I've always heard that Alan Scott was in Gotham City at some point. Yeah. But I can't promise you that the JSA was.
Starting in the 80s, they definitely played with that. You know, they'd have references to like Alan Scott having worked in Gotham City. And by the 90s, he and Batman, you know, there were stories where they not really teamed up, but connected, you know, and talked about being in the same city. But yeah, I was just curious about that because I did not guess the ending at all. I never guess endings. I don't want to give anything away, but we were off the air. We were talking about The Dark Knight Rises and how I didn't guess the ending of that. And, you know, people are like, really? You didn't guess that?
If you watch Sixth Sense, brace yourself. Just saying.
Yes. Okay. that and Citizen Kane were given away to me before I saw them.
No. But
you know, you really should see this twist coming because it's in Gotham City. I was even going, who is this? And it just, I'm like, it's not Batman. I don't know who it is.
I didn't even think about it. Same as me. The first time I read the story, did not catch that coming. Didn't even wonder who he was. It was just some kid. You know, I was like, okay, here's some kid.
I guess I had in the back of my mind, maybe he'll just be some kid. But I sort of like, I think this should be someone. And of course, it's Gordon. You're like, of course, it's Gordon. Although you made a note, and I sort of agree, doing the math here, if he's 18 in 1944, he's 71 in present day continuity.
Right.
So, and that seems a little old for Gordon, but you know, Gordon's such a badass. 71's okay. And I feel like Chaykin's the kind of writer who wouldn't care. Right.
I mean, okay. If you do Chaykin math, that probably makes the most amount of sense. That's fair. But there's no way somebody's still the commissioner of a tough town like that at 71. I just don't see
I can believe that. Sure. the art's great. The Guardian looks massive. But cool.
He does. He's huge. Yeah.
I never thought of him. I was thinking recently, I want Todd McFarlane to make a new superpowers figure of him because I think he's always just had such a cool look, but I've never thought. But if you think of him as, you know, Jack Kirby's, you know, trying again on Captain America, you know, Captain America is often drawn as massive, even if it's not, you know, Rob Liefeld. So, you know, I guess it makes sense that you could draw the Guardian as massive. He uses the term for ridiculous.
He does.
And that struck me as like an anachronism, like not only an anachronism to the 40s, like I can't believe someone said that in 1997.
I've already read ahead and saw your note, but I felt exactly the same way. I felt exactly the same way.
So I Googled around and I found dictionary.com, which is somewhat legit. I used to be a grammarian, so I cared about this crap. They date the term back to the 1920s. Ridiculous.
Jeez, so really?
I'll let it stand. I'll let Chaykin's using ridic in 1944 stand. I don't know. Guardian might be too much of a, you know, a tightwad to use it, but...
He was a hip guy. He's hanging out with kids. You kidding?
But he's a square. I don't know. I always viewed him as a square. Same as Captain America, right?
Apparently he can't tie a square knot, though. I do love that they have him. So the reason he's there, like his shtick is he's doing contests with people. Like they give money to compete against him, and they're using the money to raise for the war relief. And they get to name what it is. Like these, you know, the jerk Navy guys want to do muscle flexing, whereas Jim Gordon wants to do knot tying. So I just love that aspect. It just feels, I don't know, anything to raise money for the war effort. That's great.
And knot tying is just, you know, it doesn't make him seem like a badass that he can be Guardian, but it's still pretty cool, right?
Yeah, so, exactly.
No, that was great. A few questions. You see one of the German saboteurs, you know, in disguise dancing with a Harlequin. Wasn't she a villain back in World War II? And then she reformed and married Alan Scott. And then
so strange. That one has really got me perplexed. Yeah, he's definitely dancing with Harlequin.
Yeah.
I had to go back and look. There are lots of stories where her and Green Lantern teamed up, supposedly. Now, again, I haven't read these Golden Age stories myself. I'm not really a Golden Age comic kind of guy. I love stories set in the Golden Age nowadays, but I have a hard time reading actual Golden Age comics. But you read about how there were times where they would team up. So I'm assuming this is kind of like, it, you know, hey, it's Christmas. We'll look the other way because you're just a crook. You're not a villain. Yeah,
you're not truly evil. God, I feel so bad for that character. I mean, I like what they've done with Alan Scott in current continuity, but like, you know, she was married to him for years. You got to kind of feel bad for her.
If you read the recent, and I do too, I love Molly. I absolutely love Molly. But if you read the recent Green Alan Scott series, I mean, he says, I love Molly. I do.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't catch that. I did read it, but I didn't.
And he does genuinely love her, but he is you know, attracted to men.
It does happen. Yeah.
Yep.
So Gordon winning the knot tying contest, his prize is he gets to the ends of Black Canary, and then Black Canary, you know, helps him beat up the saboteurs. And at the end, you know, in your synopsis, you said Black Canary thanks Peoria for heroism, the heartfelt kiss. It looks more intense than that to me.
I said heartfelt. I'm trying to make it. Yeah.
I mean, it looks like more than kissing was going on. He whispers in her ear, and then you see them, you know, lip locked. His glasses are askew. I mean, I'm almost hoping for like a modern day story where like Batman teams up Black Canary and Gordon's like, hey, you know, I knew your mom, like that kind of thing. Like, it really looked like there might have been more than kissing going on. It looked pretty passionate to me, which, you know, go Jim Gordon. Like,
right,
why not?
Right. I hope she wasn't married to Larry at this point.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, she cheated on him with Starman, too, right? Remember that?
Well
story?
Aware. Be careful of it. Yeah. That upsets people. That's a trigger.
Really?
Yeah.
That was great.
I think it's a great story point. I mean, people are real. People make mistakes. But
Yeah.
I think that kiss is great. You're right. It looks very passionate. So that final page, you get you find out Hourman's been narrating the whole story. You don't even know that. Hourman's been narrating the whole story. There's this whole melancholy feeling, right, about the war, looking at the past, what's going to happen in the future. Because, you know, is the war almost over? They don't know. Then you get the reveal for the audience of it being Jim Gordon. And then Silent Night, you know, the troops crying, the kiss, the whole page, it just gives you such a warm feeling, all the feels, like feels with a Z. You know, I just, I love that page.
Yeah, it really is a nice story. And it has that kind of thing that I feel like DC was doing a lot at the time of, you know, seeing the superheroes being like real people, being social, you know, hanging out, having personalities and not making it feel forced. I feel like often when comics try to do that, they make it, they force it. Like they graft friendship onto a relationship. It's tell, don't show. And this story, even in 10 pages, really makes you feel like, you know, these people really have some kind of friendly relationship. And I always really enjoy that, as I was the kind of kid who liked realistic comics, you know, wanted to believe that superheroes could really exist. So anytime they were made to feel like real human beings, you know, it's why I love Watchmen. I mean, warts and all, that's the whole point. They were real human beings.
Well, sort of in line with that, my first JSA comic I ever read was a Justice League of America issue, number 171, The Death of Mr. Terrific. In that issue, there's a couple of maybe 2, 3, 4 pages of the JSA and the JLA just hanging out at the satellite, you know, eating sandwiches, finger sandwiches, you know, whatever. And I would pore over those pages more than the fights because I just loved the idea, like you, using your words, the social aspect of being friends with these other crime fighters. And, you know, what do you talk about? You know, things like that. And I just found it fascinating. So I didn't even think about how that applies here, but you're right. The social situation makes it that much more charming.
And it's hard to pull off. Like I say, a lot of people get it wrong, but I think in this story, Chaykin definitely does. So it's a great, fun story. The twist at the end is lovely. There's some good action. The art is fantastic. They pack in a lot of characters who are just fun to see. I mean, that's part of the appeal of All-Star Squadron, I think, is just seeing all these kind of random characters. You know, I remember loving those All-Star Squadron issues where it would be like the whole team meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, damn, like, you know, why can't they have Airwave in here more often? Right? Just seeing all these different characters, and it's part of why we loved Who's Who, right? So seeing people in the background who you know they weren't JSAers, they weren't standby Sargon and Phantom Lady and all that. So it's nice. And in a 10-page story, it doesn't have time to get old, doesn't have time to get stale. It's really a wonderful story, and you're right, it has a touching ending. So it balances a lot, and Chaykin and Burchett really pull it off.
They do. I mean, they're pros. They already, by this point, even in 97, they already knew what they were doing. But man, they really shine here because it's difficult to tell a short story. I mean, that's one of the things Marty Pasco used to talk about, was it's actually easier to write a 22-page story than an 8-page story, things like that. But now, going back to your point about all the different characters, so I'm just going to rattle off, folks. There's a bunch of JSA members in here. But going beyond the JSA members, you've already mentioned a few of them. You get Star-Spangled Kid and Stripes here, there. We mentioned Mary, Girl of a Thousand Gimmicks, who's Star-Spangled Kid's adopted sister, so they're actually together in some of the scenes. Liberty Bell is there. Phantom Lady, there's a funny bit where Phantom Lady, she's signing autographs, and she's just surrounded by GIs. And one of them's got this stick, like a little fishing pole, hanging it over her head with mistletoe, which is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
You get the Newsboy Legion. They're over there. You know, they're waiting tables. As you mentioned, Sargon, he's doing magic. Harlequin's dancing. You got Ma Hunkle in the kitchen, which is great. Yeah. And she's badass. And she's threatening people. And she even mentioned Scribbly, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
There's one thing, too, I want to mention. So it's covered by the name of the story. I didn't catch it until I started getting ready for this episode. But there, underneath the name of the story, there's actually a photographer who's bent down taking a posed picture of Liberty Bell's backside. So getting a little girly action there.
Yeah, she seems perfectly happy about it. She's got a big smile on her face.
She is posing, yeah. Oh, and then completely out of continuity, it's got to be, you actually have Mary Marvel.
Yeah.
So, which is really strange. I mean, she's just a teeny tiny little character. I got to imagine the artist just wanted to draw her or just didn't know that she was wiped from continuity. I don't know. But a super fun, so many nice little artistic cameos. I love Jay Garrick decorating the Christmas tree at super speed and all, you know, the GI standing around watching him like, ooh, wow. So much fun, beautiful illustrations, and just beautiful illustrations with lots of little Easter eggs. It's so much fun just to look at.
And so much personality on the characters' faces. I'm looking at it again, and every character, the way they smile, the way they frown, the way they cheer, he packs so much into. I mean, that's really what makes a great comic artist, is you give these people personality and you make them unique. He really pulls it off.
Yeah, and like, you know, I love also that personality. Like, they gave the Atom, a guy who's got a full face mask, you can't see a single thing on him, they show him looking pissed because he has to go mop the bathroom and he's mad. He's like, where's Dr. Fate when someone's got to clean the toilet, you know, which is a great line, but you see, you can tell by the body language. He's like, whoa, wait. Yeah. And I love that. You're right. It's in the art. It's in the story. All of it is great.
I always thought that was the trick of drawing Spider-Man, is since you couldn't see his mouth, and the good Spider-Man artists pulled that off. So I don't know. Did Burchett ever draw Spider-Man? You know, this kind of attests to he would have pulled it off well, maybe.
They've done so many, you know, kid-friendly Spider-Man books over the years. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, worth looking for. Yeah.
By the way, Johnny Thunder is in here too, doing like a comedy routine with the Thunderbolt, like a ventriloquist act, which looks funny and silly. But I love that it's so cleverly set up that Gordon is doing laundry, you know, on this dry dock ship. And that's why he's able to figure out the saboteurs, which I thought was super clever.
Yeah, no, it's a well-written story. Like you said, in 10 pages, he pulls off a lot, including a plot that makes sense, logically makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah, it's terrific.
So I think it's fair to say we enjoyed this.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, it's from an era, I was reading a ton of DC and Marvel in 97, 98, buying the floppies still. And, you know, I'm surprised I didn't pick this up because this kind of thing's right up my alley. And I was loving JSA at the time. I mean, this was pre-Jeff Johns JSA, right? I think that was 99?
Yeah, this is a couple years before.
So what was going on with the JSA at the time? Were they showing up anywhere regularly?
No, not well. I mean, individually, like, you know, Alan was showing up in Green Lantern, Jay was showing up in Flash, things like that. But no, we were just almost to the point where we'd start getting the JSA stuff, but not yet.
I mean, they were referenced in Starman a lot.
Of course, the Starman book, duh.
Which I was super into. So yeah, they've always been favorites of mine. And, you know, this was an era where I was about all things DC. So I'm sad I missed this at the time, but it's always nice to revisit that era because there was a lot of good stuff. It was, you know, I think it's kind of underrated, but I think it was a great era for DC.
And if you haven't read these Holiday Bash books, they're out on DC Infinite. Give them a listen. They're absolutely wonderful top to bottom. And there's like, I think 3 years of them. So they're good stuff.
Cool.
Now, this is the part of the show where we issue the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it be a story beat, something in the art, someone made us laugh, whatever. Both myself and Noah are going to pick one moment each to spotlight, and those will earn the All-Star Award. What is your All-Star nomination, Noah?
Well, I want to go with the reveal that it's Jim Gordon, but that just seems too obvious. So I'm going to go with my favorite panel here, which we haven't mentioned. It's on page... God, my sight, I can't even see here. But one of the last pages, it's basically the saboteurs have, they whack Gordon over the head with the bomb, which looks really painful. And then Black Canary to the rescue. So there's this big diagonal triangular panel of Black Canary just like swooping into the frame, kicking the dude in the face. She looks so badass. She looks so sexy. The fishnets are right there in your face. You know, the boot with the big cuff is just nailed him across the face. It's really perfect. It's like, it is iconic of a character like Black Canary, like a badass, sexy woman. And this goon is just falling backward and he goes, and knowing he's a Nazi makes you like it even more. So yeah, just a fantastic panel that wraps up everything I love about God, female superheroes and superheroes in general.
It's a fantastic panel. She's so powerful, so in control, everything you just said. And now you think about this gorgeous blonde lady that Jim had a thing for. It makes me wonder if maybe that's why he likes Sarah Essen later. I don't know.
She was blonde? I guess I didn't remember that.
That's my memory, but you know, I forget things all the time. So
I know. What was his first wife? Was she blonde? Was she a brunette?
I have no idea. I was going to say, assume a redhead, but he was a redhead.
He was a redhead, right?
No idea.
And Barbara is not his biological daughter in most continuities, right? So it doesn't really matter.
It all depends on the week.
Who cares anymore?
Exactly. Yeah. And nowadays, it all matters, right? It's all correct nowadays.
It's all correct in various universes. Yes.
Well, I'm gonna cop out and totally pick the reveal because actually, I'm just gonna pick that whole last page is what I'm gonna do. As I said, the singing, the silent night, the troops crying, the kiss, that super passionate kiss. And the reveal of James Gordon, that's what's going to get my All-Star Award. So both of them are great moments in the book, the story, and both of them are well-deserved of the All-Star Award. So wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our love for that moment. Now, Noah, we're going to do a quick special feature here right before we get going here. We're each going to name a favorite holiday-themed comic story from any era, about any team, doesn't really matter at all, and just something fun to share. So what do you got?
Well, from that same era, February 1997, Starman number 27. We mentioned the James Robinson Starman. This was my first issue of the James Robinson Starman. It got me hooked. It's the Christmas issue. It's Christmas Eve, and Jack Knight finds himself teaming up with a homeless man in a Santa suit. It exemplifies everything that made this series both great and, honestly, in hindsight, a little silly. It's got a lot of heart. It's got a lot of humanity. It's got a lot of action. It's got a lot of pretentious cultural references. It's got a lot of contrived dialogue. But I just reread it. It's a great story. It's definitely one of the best single issues of that whole series. And it's just a lovely, touching Christmas story like this one.
It's absolutely a wonderful story. I just reread it recently. And folks, if you know anything about me, I plan years in advance. And I will give you a little tip for next year. That's going to be one of our Christmas stories we're covering next year. It's already on the books. Already got my guest booked. It's all been planned already. It's just that good. I picked another short story from another collection from the DCU Holiday Special number 1 from 2008. It was an 8-page Aquaman story. And the setting is they're out on the high seas in a storm, and there's this husband and his pregnant wife. They've been hijacked by pirates, and Aquaman saves the couple. They're lost at sea. They don't know where to go. Aquaman steers the ship to save this couple. He follows his own father's shining lighthouse to shore, only to discover it wasn't the lighthouse after all. It was the star behind the lighthouse that he was following. Waiting ashore for this pregnant woman are two men dressed like kings, bearing gifts. Aquaman puts it all together, and he's the third king. So he kneels before the unborn child, and Aquaman later swims away filled with hope. And the recap makes the story sound silly. But I'm telling you, folks, and I'm not a deeply religious guy by any means, people, but this story moved me. It was really powerful. I can't explain why it gets to me. I've read it several times now over the years, and I just love it. And the most amazing thing about this is the story is written by Dan DiDio. Which is crazy, because he's not somebody usually, think in your head writing good stories. But just love it.
Is this quite possibly the most religious DC Comics superhero story ever?
I'm sure there's probably more. But as far as comes to my mind, for me, most obvious, it seems like. But I'm sure there's other ones. There's got to be.
Actually, that's funny, because not long ago, I was on an episode of Rob's Super Friends podcast, and we talked about the backup story, Seraph, which was a pretty religious Jewish story. So I contradict myself here. But, I mean, I read this story, seeing your recommendation, and I really enjoyed it. You're right. It's excellent. But I was almost floored by, God, so many Christmas stories, but hardly any of them referenced. I mean, none of them I can think of reference Jesus Christ.
Right.
And this one flat out does. I mean, it's hats off to DiDio. I mean, it felt a little bold from my point of view.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder, I don't particularly care, but it makes me wonder a bit, is he a religious guy? Is this a important thing in his life? And he was looking for a way to add that to an Aquaman story, as crazy as it sounds. He made it work.
He really does. It comes out of the left field. You don't expect it. And by the end of it, you're like, huh. And kind of like what you said about this story, it's short enough that it doesn't overstay its welcome. It gets it done. So again, that's from DC Holiday Special number 1. All these are out on DC Infinite. You can check it out there. And they actually had a really good run of holiday specials from 2008, 2009, 2010. I did several years of those. They're all really good. So these great reading for you this time of year, folks. This episode is dropping right before Christmas, so perfect time to get out there and read some holiday comics. Now, Noah, I need to ask you a favor.
Yes.
Would you mind hanging out here at the Justice Society canteen for a bit? Once the audience starts booing Johnny Thunder's comedy routine, and I use the word comedy loosely, I figure that maybe some holiday trivia might liven things up.
Yeah, sure. That's what I do, especially this time of year. I'd love to hang out, especially considering the company there. Even if I don't get to dance with Black Canary or Phantom Lady or...
Hey, Liberty Bell's there too. You never know.
I know. Something about those little jodhpurs, the little mm-hmm. things, the riding things, something about that I find appealing. I don't know what that is.
Firebrand and Liberty Bell, some of my earliest comic crushes. Absolutely.
Yeah, there's something, I don't know. It's no accounting for taste, but that does something for me.
Now, don't worry, Noah. We will bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'll be joined by our second co-host for this episode to discuss the Wesley Dodds Sandman Mystery Theater holiday story from 1997.
I'm Bill Scurry.
And I'm Noah Tarno.
And we're both very, very old.
Well, we're both 45, but that's certainly a lot older than either of us ever planned on getting.
And we're facing the horrible prospect, nay, the reality that pop culture has passed us by.
So every week, we bravely pick one newfangled performer, artist, trend, or phenomenon that's all the rage among kids these days. Or at least among people whose brains have become less antiquated than ours. and we try to make some sense of it.
Sometimes we hate it. Sometimes we like it. Sometimes we get it. Sometimes we don't.
But always, we complain.
We are talking about Tekashi 6-9.
I cannot believe that until you suggested this as a topic like 2 weeks ago, I had never heard of this guy.
A banger was just unleashed upon the American people called WAP. You know, we talked about K-pop, we talked about Cardi B, the people who are in the mold of, like, every single time they drop something on you, it's got to own the conversation. We are discussing what we do in the shadows.
This isn't my thing, but they get the details right. It's well acted, it's funny. The mockumentary format they make work for them. Yes, Supreme, my favorite clothing line named after a Rob Liefeld comic book character.
This is another thing I get lost on. It's like, what the f*** does authentic mean? It's a shirt. How is the shirt I'm wearing authentic?
There is such a fetishization of authenticity in our culture.
It's I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn cast.
Available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. Whatever those things are.
We're back from break, and I have clearly taken some cold medicine, or maybe, just maybe, these segments were not actually recorded back-to-back. I will let you decide on that one, folks. I am here with our second co-host for this episode, and I've got a fellow podcaster from the Fire & Water Podcast Network. He headlines the Exceptional Cheers cast, where they are very excited to begin their coverage very soon of the spinoff, The Tortellis. Previously, he hosted the excellent Secret Origins podcast, where he extolled the virtues of Roy Thomas week after week, covering every issue, which included numerous members of the JSA. And finally, he's been voted 3 years running the man most likely to spike the punch bowl at the office holiday party. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Ryan Daly. Welcome to the holidays at the JSA Brownstone. Ryan, thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
You know, I can't complain. I mean, I could, but you asked me not to complain. So.
That is kind of your go-to move, so.
Sure, yeah. And thank you for the wonderful intro. Yes, listener, long-time listeners know how much I adore Roy Thomas, and I've never had an ill thing to say about the man or his work on these particular characters. Yeah.
Taking the sarcasm out, you did genuinely potentially save his life at one point, though, and for real. So it happened. So that is not a lie, folks.
Yeah.
Now, folks, we are going to cover a special.
give me as much credit for almost saving Roy Thomas's life as he wants credit for, let's say, creating Wolverine.
Oh, see, you had to go there. Now I'm going to give four more angry comments. Thank you so much for that. Anyway, folks, we are here to celebrate another fantastic holiday story. As I told you in the opening, we're covering a Sandman Mystery Theater holiday story, which is great. Now, Ryan, you are one of the people I know that love Sandman Mystery Theater. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to the book and your passion for it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is fortuitous that you're doing a JSA in the 1990s related podcast, because in the 1990s, that is when comic book reading and collecting became my primary hobby. I had read some comics in the 80s, but by the 90s, that was when my life became school, reading comics and collecting comics, and then a distant third was friends and family. And just because of what I was exposed to, you know, first, like, I mean, I was totally into the superhero genre. I was a big Marvel zombie because my comic collecting kind of dovetailed in with the animated series for, like, X-Men and Spider-Man and things like that. I knew some DC, but I wasn't as big a fan at the time. I was there on opening night for Image Comics, and, you know, I was collecting a bunch of those things. But as the decade progressed, by the time we got to the late 1990s, those were in parallel with my high school years. And by this point, my attention started to turn away from superheroes to what I perhaps mistakenly thought was more mature reading, more sophisticated storytelling. I went into more genre comics, sort of like crime noir, horror, like the unconventional kind of oddball superheroes. And the big ones that I really got into at this time, these are like the really popular ones. Frank Miller's Sin City, obviously. Mike Mignola's Hellboy. For a little while, the Poison Elves series. I don't know how many people remember that one. The Aliens comics that were published by Dark Horse that were licensed from 20th Century Fox. That's a shout out to Diablo Frank and his podcast. And then the other one this time was Sandman Mystery Theater. Now, I got into this book because I went to cover with issue 68. And if you know the series, Sandman Mystery Theater ended with issue 70.
Well played, sir. Well played.
Yeah. But luckily, because it was the 90s, there was an abundance of comic book retailers and venues, like five different places I could buy comics within bike riding distance, or by that point, driving distance.
What we call the good old days.
Yeah. So I was able to get a pretty decent chunk of the old back issues. And then for a little while, DC started publishing trades, and they've never been able to completely finish the series in trade paperback, even though they've tried it like three times. But to the other question, the reason why I kind of fell in love with it and the reason why I'm here on this podcast, Sandman as a character kind of resonated with me for a couple of different reasons. One, and this holds true with all of the JSA characters, is the era and the setting of their creation. I have always loved that period between World War I and World War II. I love the fashion, like the suits, the fact that guys always wore fedora hats, even indoors. I love the look of the cars. I love the Tommy guns. Like, just, I watched The Untouchables a lot growing up.
It's so good.
It is really good, but yeah, like, I couldn't get enough of that. And so just the aesthetic of that, and then discovering a comic book kind of set in that world and that era, really drew me in. I liked the idea of the urban vigilante working outside the law, sometimes against the law, but it's very similar to Batman. That's what got me into that. But he was in a world of gangsters and femme fatale, that type of thing. He had one foot in the realm of superheroes because of his connection to the JSA and the costume, but he didn't have a garish costume, a garish look to that. Instead, the look would be, it would be something practical, but noticeably of that era, that you could like point down to the area. And like with Sandman, with the mystery theater version, he's got a gas mask that is not this stylized sci-fi thing. It's a authentic World War One, you know, trench warfare kind of gas mask. But that also cloaks his identity, but it also makes him instantly identifiable. So that signature look, I hooked onto. There's something alien and unnatural about him, about his head, but the rest of his body looks very pedestrian and normal. He's wearing a suit and tie and a trench coat. And I originally had hoped to find this type of hero with The Shadow, and I was really excited for that movie when it came out. And it was a big disappointment. Now, I have come since then to enjoy that movie, the Alec Baldwin version. But at the time, I did not like it. It was not what I wanted. But yeah, the Vertigo's reinvention of the Golden Age Sandman hit me in the sweet spot, exactly what I wanted. He looked like a private investigator, but the mask gave him this weird, sinister kind of vibe to him. He fought gangsters and serial killers and pedophile kind of uncomfortably. The stories were dark, kind of nihilistic. The writing and the art, like, it was, they were, all the stories were four issues long, and each chapter was called an act, like in a play. So that kind of made me feel like it was more literary, again, more sophisticated what I was going for, trying to trick myself that these weren't just funny books for kids. And then very also importantly, and this will be the last thing I kind of mentioned for why I like the character in the book, Sandman had a girlfriend who was not just the damsel in distress at the time. She knew his identity, and she was proactive. She helped him a lot in his cases. She was a competent early feminist hero in her own right. And the two of them, Wesley and Diane, had a lot of sex in those comics. So,
I mean, you're not wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I came to the book, thanks for asking, by the way, I was there when it launched. I was working in the comic book shop, I was all in on Vertigo, I had gone through my superhero phase, I was at this point in my dark phase, where I only wanted to read, quote-unquote, mature books, things like that. So this came along at the right time, because I loved the JSA, and here comes this book, and I'm like, this is the melding of both worlds, it's amazing! And really enjoyed it. It was a hard read, though, because, I mean, some of the things that happened to the victims was horrible. I mean, just deeply upsetting. And I don't know how long I stuck with it. I know I didn't make it to the end, and it's probably not like I consciously gave up on it. I probably just wandered away and got distracted. I know I got back into superheroes after a while, so that may have been what partially did it, but just always loved this era. I loved the genre. Everything you just said about the look and the time period was phenomenal. And for me, it's...
This reading the story too brings back just so many happy memories of reading that book. He lived in such a violent, grungy world, you know. And again, we're good people, we're hurt, and that's not something you'd see in other comics. And he stood up for them, and he did something about it, and it resonated with me, and it meant a lot to me. So really, I was thrilled with the opportunity to dive back into this, and I do plan to talk more about Sandman Mystery Theater on JSA in the 90s. We're going to do an episode dedicated to it, so watch for more of that. Now, some of you folks at home might remember when we first launched this podcast, not JSA in the 90s, but Justice Society Presents, this feed, we had a commercial where we announced we were going to have regular episodes on Sandman Mystery Theater. Well, for a lot of reasons, unfortunately, that didn't get a chance to materialize. And Ryan was going to be part of that, but that's part of the reason I had to have him on this episode to talk about Sandman Mystery Theater. So I'm thrilled you're here, sir.
I am thrilled to have this opportunity, and I am going to be very annoying and say that podcast could still happen. We might still do the Mystery Theater show just because I want to call dibs and I don't want anybody else to do it.
So, folks, we are going to post maybe one or two pages from this story on our website. I mean, it's only an 8-page story, so I'm not going to post the whole thing. But you can go out to our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can see the gallery post for this episode. You'll see a couple of pages from it. If you want to read the whole story, find a book called Vertigo, Winter's Edge, Number 1. So it was published by DC Comics. It's got a cover date of January 1998, but it was actually on the shelves November 26th, 1997. You can find this thing on DC Comics Infinite on Ultra level. So if you have the Ultra level and you get all the Vertigo stuff, it's there for you. So Vertigo, Winter's Edge Number 1. This thing had a cover price of $7.95. That was very expensive even back then. It's very expensive now, but it's 96 pages of really interesting stuff, collecting a whole bunch of stories featuring characters from The Sandman, House of Secrets, The Dreaming, Hellblazer, Books of Magic, The Invisibles, has an interview about Preacher in it. I mean, there's just so many great titles I loved back then. And it includes, obviously, this story, which is called Spirit of the Season, featuring Wesley Dodds from Sandman Mystery Theater. Now, it's an 8-page story. Plot is by Matt Wagner and Steven Siegel. The dialogue is by Steven Siegel. Art is by John K. Schneider III. Letter is John Costanza. Colorist is Bjarne Hansen. Editors are Karen Berger and Shelley Roberg. Now, I'm going to give a recap of the story, and then we're going to get into the discussion. So here we go, folks. Diane Belmont is enjoying a festive day of Christmas shopping, while her boyfriend, Wesley Dodds, tags along, carrying numerous packages. Wesley sneaks away to visit a nearby synagogue, reflecting on his reasons for coming and feeling uncomfortable about sharing them with Diane. He's there to remember his mother, who passed away years ago, and today marks the anniversary of her death, and he wishes to see her observance plaque and the lit candle. But he's too late. He's got the date wrong by a whole week. Wesley feels ashamed for forgetting the date of his own mother's passing. He sits with a Kaddish, a morning prayer, intending to read it aloud to find peace, but he finds his faith lacking. Wesley overhears another deeply saddened worshiper, Yara Karoff, who shares her story of escaping Nazi-controlled Warsaw as a teen and being helped by Alexei, a man she grew to love. Heartbroken, Yara reveals Alexei died 4 days ago. She hasn't slept since. Just then, three thieves storm the synagogue, bludgeon the rabbi, assault Yara, and steal a golden menorah and candlesticks. The Sandman confronts them, enraged by the desecration of the Hebrew temple. After a fierce brawl, he knocks out the thieves, saving Yara's life at the last moment. In the aftermath, the Sandman realizes justice is about balance, providing what is needed as well as what is required. He grants Yara the gift of sleep to a distraught woman who hasn't slept in 4 days. Before departing, the Sandman asks the rabbi to keep the candles lit, preserving hope and respect for tradition in the neighborhood. In the end, Wesley reunites with Diane and looks forward to sharing the story of his visit with her. Man, 8 pages. They packed a lot in here. So yeah. why don't you walk us through here, and I'll just chime in as you go, buddy.
First of all, I have to say this is the second podcast that I've done in as many months with a very overt Jewish theme and with the subject matter and everything. And the last time I recorded an episode of Cheers Cast with our buddy Sean Ross, who I guess is now called our go-to Jew in some corners.
Wow. Okay.
That's what Clinton Robinson called him, and that's what he calls himself. So. Yeah. So yeah, thank glad you got me on this one. But okay, like off the top, I gotta mention the art struck me right away. And I think it had an effect on me because it's very different than the Guy Davis art that I'm so used to seeing with Sandman Mystery Theater. And Guy Davis wasn't on every arc, but he was on every other arc for a long time. Like, he would do a four-issue run, take a break, four-issue run, take a break. And that kind of was his trend. So he was kind of the overall art director of Sandman Mystery Theater.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah.
And John K. Snyder's art is quite different, I would say. But it's really good, and he has a heavy use of inks. It's moody. It feels atmospheric. In some panels, it really reminds me of Mike Mignola's style, who's another guy I really, really like. I love that Wesley is frequently inked and or colored in complete shadow, because that kind of reflects his dour and his somber state of mind, and the kind of ever-present darkness of his worldview and how cynical he is. In particular, one of my favorite parts is on page two, when the rabbi hands him the Kedish and he's looking at it. And even though you can't see some of his face, there's just like a slope to the eyebrow, as thin as it is, that just you get the sense of guilt and shame and sadness just on this guy, that of how horrified he is that he couldn't remember when his mom died.
It's astounding. It with just a couple of lines and mostly just shadow. It's the slope of the nose. And as you said, the eyebrow and the slightly down tilted head. It's so minimalistic, but so effective.
Right. And I think Sandman, as we talked about, Sandman Mystery Theater's each story arc was four issues. And that was the trend before we got to this era where we kind of call comics decompressed now, or writing for the trade. And when that really became popularized, Sandman Mystery Theater was doing that long before that. And because the story arcs were all four issues, there was a lot more breathing room. So to condense a Sandman story in eight pages, it's a tough transition, but I do give the writers and the artists credit, because they hit a lot of the notes and they get the character aspects that I like. The fact that Wesley is very jaded and cynical when he walks in there, when he hears Yara's story and she's talking about Alexei, his first thought is, oh, I'm assuming this Alexei guy brutalized you or in some way he's been a bad you. And she's like, no, he's the best thing in my life until he died. And Wesley, oh, I'll shut up. I'll let you tell the story.
That twist was so great. Cause it just sets you up to assume in fiction that that's where that's going, is the older guy taking advantage of her. And so her story was heartbreaking, and the Alexei twist was I hate to say, refreshing is the only word I can think of. It's surprising that it wasn't something horrible. So that was really nice.
Right.
And actually, before you go any further, I got to go back a step about John K. Snyder III. Because I'm an easy mark for him. Anything he does, I'm just in love with. So you're not going to hear a bad word out of me about this story on art-wise. I just love it. And I will say, I wasn't always the biggest Guy Davis fan on Samurai Mystery Theater. I thought it was great, and I loved that he was sort of the showrunner, right, for visually how that book was supposed to look, and he did some amazing stuff. But there's something about his style that just didn't light my fire. It's not that it was bad, but I just wasn't in love with it. So when I see this, I'm like, ooh, this is it captures the spirit of what Guy Davis was putting forward, but I love this art, so I just felt differently. My heart soared when I read this.
I totally hear that, and I would never put Guy Davis up as one of my favorite artists, but just because he was so central to that book, I tend to favor him and give him a little leeway, just because, like, I can't separate Sandman Mystery Theater from Guy Davis.
No, that's fair.
I kind of feel the same way, strangely, about Don Perlin's art on Werewolf by Night. Even though Don Perlin, he's not a very great or, like, exciting artist to me, but he was on that book for so much, and that's one of my favorite comics that I just kind of, I'm always like, oh, Don Perlin, that's cool, even though it really shouldn't be. So as I was saying, like, When I saw this, when I started reading the story, it was kind of a jarring transition, because I was like, this doesn't look like the Sandman I'm used to seeing. And I will say, the one critique I might level is that this art doesn't give me the sense of the time and the era. This feels a little bit more timeless, like the story really could have been at any time. And the era and the time period is so central to my appreciation for the story. So that's a little bit of my own personal preference bias into that decision. But it's not a bad thing. And yeah, but like what he's able to convey emotionally in a kind of minimalist style, I really like.
I think that, like, artistically, I think he put the elements in he needed there to make it look like the 30s, you know, the cars, the outfits, the Nazi symbolism, things like that. But the story, I totally agree. It was actually one of my notes, too, was that this story could have took place at any time. They could have wrote this story about 2024, just change Yara's history from being about Warsaw to being, I don't know, Syria or Afghanistan or some other country that she, you know, she had to run from to save her life. So the story doesn't lock it into the 1930s at all. But I felt like Schneider did a pretty good job with the art on that regard. But
yeah,
again, I'm an easy mark for him, man. I'm going to love it no matter what.
Agreed. And the other little artistic touch, and I'm pretty sure that you feel the same about it. I love when he draws Wesley in shadow, but his glasses are still like just lit up like white circles kind of in the darkness. It's a really cool. First of all, I love the fact that Wesley Dodds just wears glasses. Like, how often do you see a superhero alter ego or alter identity wearing glasses? It's just like a non thing, like, unless it's part of a disguise. Like,
I was gonna say that there's a guy named Clark Kent you might have heard of, but okay.
Right. But those are more for an effect, and this one is.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I think even if you don't think about it, you don't realize it, drawing him that way with the circular, with the white circles for his glasses, for his eyes, it kind of looks like the gas mask look because they're the same shape as the gas mask lenses. So.
You know what it kind of reminds me of? And this is super cheesy, but if you ever watched X-Files, whenever Scully would be writing her entry in her little computer, she had circular flat glasses. And pretty much you couldn't see her eyes. You would see the reflection of the computer, and she would have these like glowing circular lenses in front of her. And that's kind of what it reminds me of here. Mm. And the 90s, it's the same kind of time period. So interesting.
Right. Yeah.
But I love that. Yeah, they look like little mirrors, and they look great. Yeah. Now, for me, I got to say, like, I just found the whole story incredibly moving, you know, like, because I've been, especially lately, I mainly just read superhero comics nowadays. I mean, that's where my passion is. This is what I do. So it's not often I really engage with, you know, the quote unquote mature reader's book. And I do feel like this is written for a more mature audience. And this one also has a very positive message. And it just awoke so much in me. I already mentioned, you know, there's all the feels from the old Sam Raimi Mystery Theater. And you mentioned, you know, it's really hard to cram all this in 8 pages. But I got to say, wow. I mean, these guys packed all the feels into 8 pages. Almost every page elicits a strong emotional reaction. It's like an emotional roller coaster. Like, you get one page, you feel this compassion for Wesley having lost his mother. Then you feel the regret that Wesley forgot that she died and his loss of faith, or forgot the date of her death, I mean. You get the heartbreaking ache for Yara's story. Then it switches to disgust when the thieves are, like, you know, bludgeoning the rabbi and Yara. Mm-hmm. Then you get this, and I'm not ashamed to admit, I had my own cathartic hooray reaction when Wesley beats the crap out of these thieves. Like, yeah, you feel really good when he does that. And finally, there's a sense of hope when Yara gets to sleep and Saman has the discussion with Rabbi about keeping the candles lit. And right. So I'm like, what a roller coaster in just 8 pages. Wow.
And I also just I liked the way that this story is different because it's a holiday special, but this is not a Christmas story. It's a Hanukkah story because there are other holidays in this time besides Christmas. And I thought the representation was nice and well needed. And kind of going along with the last thing that you were saying, one of the main themes of Hanukkah, as I have been made to understand, again, it's not my thing. Sean Ross could be the better authority on this. But one of the main themes of it is light overcoming darkness. And we see that in the story. It's very overt a few times when they talk about lighting the candle, keeping that on. The fact that the menorah is used as, you know, as a weapon at one point and how important it is at the end. And that's also kind of symbolically the whole theme of superheroes in general. It's being the light, being the defender in a world that is bleak and oftentimes oppressive and dangerous and scary and dark. That's what the Sandman in particular and kind of superheroes in general represent, is that light of hope, that beacon, that sense of safety. And yeah, just that there's something else out there that is protecting you.
Well, there's even you said very in your face about it. I mean, the guy tries to hit Yara with the menorah. Salmon blocks his hand, stops the menorah from hitting her, and he says, "I am the protector of the light." So yeah, I mean, they're making it very obvious. And I love it for it. You know, I love that they took the time to put this story in here to show representation of other cultures. I love that they made the menorah and the light a critical part of the story. And again, I'm not of the Jewish faith, so I don't know if it's misrepresented or not, but I really enjoyed it, and I felt it was very uplifting.
Yeah. Because ultimately it's about a character finding peace. In a sense, even though Wesley himself may be an atheist, he understands that the peace that the temple or the church or whatever religious or spirituality you have, it brings peace and comfort to the people, which is what Sandman tries to do himself. And that's reaffirming of his position in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And then speaking specifically of bringing peace to others, I did not see him. I should have, but they almost telegraphed it, but I didn't pick it up, that he was going to give Yara the gift of sleep at the end. I was like, oh, that was very nice of Wesley to do that. Now, I believe she's also looking for a place to stay and food and someone to bury her dead husband, but at least he did give her the gift of sleep. So that was very nice.
Yeah, Wesley's pretty wealthy. He could have floated that bill too. But
maybe he did. I don't know.
I love those two panels, the close-up of her face on the last page, on page 8, when it's just like the mist in front of her. And as she closes her eyes, the smile on her face as she embraces it. Because I'll give you, typically when the Sandman gasses somebody, it's not a relief. they're not smiling and thanking him for when it happens. It's quite often a very different experience. But yeah, so that was a nice touch.
I mentioned the cathartic release. So on the page before that, on page 7, he's defeating the final bad guy, and dude, he is shooting a full blast of that gas gun about 2 inches from that dude's nose. I mean, it is just choke. Like, it, again, it's just this cathartic, like, yeah, beat the hell out of this guy.
And the panel before that, when he actually gets the second goon in a headlock and everything, it looks like, it's kind of hard, but it looks like he just drives his knee into the guy's chest or something like that.
He says, "Who put out the lights?"
You did. And certainly one of the highlights of this, because they have to cram so much in and these pages are dense and compacted, but we still get a nice heroic debut, a nice entrance. And I love the panel before, this tiny little panel where you just see, it's like a reverse silhouette. The background is all in black, but we get white silhouettes of the three goons and the Sandman making his shadowy entrance on the floor. And then we cut to the big panel of him holding the gas gun. And no matter how it was drawn, no matter how many times, I never get tired of looking at an image of just the Sandman in his costume with the mask, holding that gas gun and pointing that. I love that so much. I used to have like 4 different desktop wallpapers drawn by Francesco Francavilla of that type of image of him doing Sandman. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Wow. Okay. Yeah. That hero entrance shot is amazing. So good. By the way, doing my research for this, I found out that our friend Henry Bernstein, his podcast, which is called Funny, They Don't Look Jewish, they actually covered this story back in 2021. So I did not know that anyone remembered the story existed. So I was very excited to see more coverage of it out there.
Oh, well, I hope we didn't copy exactly.
So, folks, this is where we are now going to nominate the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, you know, whatever it might be. Both myself and Ryan are going to pick one moment each to spotlight, and both of those moments will earn an All-Star Award. So, Ryan, you're the guest. What was your moment to nominate for the All-Star Award?
So I came very close to nominating just his heroic entrance, that big panel of him with the costume. That was such a good moment. But I actually surprised myself, and there was something else a little bit more subtle that I really liked in the story. And it's on the 7th page. It's when Yara tackles the third goon and tries or gets her arm around his leg. And he's like, "Get, let go." And she says, I will lose nothing more, nothing. And he's about to hit her with a menorah, as you described, and Sandman stops him. But just her act of defiance, the fact that she wasn't going to be a victim and she was going to fight back in some small way, I like that as a character moment for Yara, for this character that we're just getting to meet. But also because, in a way, it reminds me of the series in general and what an important part Diane was, and that Diane wasn't this helpless woman who needed the guy to protect her all the time. She got involved. She took a part. A lot of times it brought more danger to her, but she wasn't afraid and she wasn't passive. So I just kind of thought, like, if this is your first experience with Sandman Mystery Theater, even though this woman is not Diane and we're not going to see this woman again, it's really cool that this kind of gives you a flavor of what you can expect in that regard. And that, yeah, with the woman in Wesley's life is a pretty active and proactive part of his crime fighting career.
That's a great pick. To make it even better, if you go one page back, she actually attacks the guys twice. So the first, the previous page, the same as the hero shot, she's the one leaping at the guy saying, "You will not steal our light. This is a house of God." And he smacks her with a bag and she gets knocked down. And so she got back up and came at him again. So yeah, great pick. My pick is also with Yara. It's the moment where she's granted sleep. Mm-hmm. Just the joy on her face. I mean, it almost looks photorealistic the way and so I mean regardless, we both picked a Yara moment. They're both great moments. So congratulations, Yara, you have won in both regards our all-star awards. So please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our love for these moments. Now, we're going to do, very quickly, a quick special feature where we are each going to name one other favorite holiday-themed comic book from any era. It doesn't have to be JSA, it could be anything. So, Ryan, what is your pick that you want to share with people?
This one probably is going to surprise a lot of people. It surprised me as much because I wanted to go with, like, a Daredevil issue or a Hellboy story or, like, something else that kind of goes with what I was describing as the sophistication of this. But I went with a story that had a big effect on me when I was younger. And I went with Generation X, issue 4, published on December 13th, 1994.
That is not a book I would have expected.
the story in it is called Between the Cracks. It was written by Scott Lobdell and drawn by Chris Bacalo, who was another one of my favorite artists, especially at that time.
Oh, hell yeah.
And this Generation X was my young X-Men book, because by the time I was getting into the comics and the X-Men, like, the New Mutants were transitioning to X-Force. They were kind of grown up already. So Generation X, I got in from the ground floor. They were young. They were teenagers. The fact that they called themselves Generation X, and I used to think I was Generation X because we didn't have millennials yet. that term wouldn't apply to anything. So, yeah, I really enjoyed the books. I like the characters. As I mentioned, I loved Chris Bacalo's art for a long, long time. He was my favorite artist for a while. Any story that he drew, it was quirky and oddball, but still dynamic. This particular story, and I won't go in through all of the details, but it involves a hostage situation at a public school in which this kid, with his very obvious, grotesque physical deformity, takes this classroom hostage. And he doesn't want money. He doesn't want power. He just wants to be treated like a human being. He wants access to the education that the school board has denied him because of their anti-mutant discrimination. And boy, does this still resonate today, damn it. And by the end of the story, we learn kind of tragically that the kid isn't even a mutant. He just has this birth deformity that makes him look monstrous, but horrible things still end up ensuing. This tragedy at the very end, still everything goes wrong. And it's a story that tells how intolerance can be a fire that blazes out of control and it burns anyone who is different. And I particularly loved the last bit of dialogue when one of the Gen X kids there's talking about how he's this poor kid who suffered the bigotry of humanity without the benefit of a cool superpower, at least because he wasn't even one of them. And Banshee, Sean Cassidy, says he was one of us in the only way that matters. He's another kid who fell between the cracks. And oh, wow. that line of dialogue, so I was like, phew. I think, when Scott Lobdell wrote that line, he's like, I'm done for the day. I'm going to take a break.
That really was a great book. I haven't really given it a lot of thought in years, but I loved it.
I haven't either. I thought the quality went downhill really fast.
Okay.
But the first couple of issues, like the first year, I loved it.
Chris Bacalo was amazing, right? He did this. He did Death, the High Cost of Living. He did Shay the Changing Man. I mean, there's so much of what I loved was intersecting with him and all the stuff I just edited out that was wrong that Ryan corrected me on. But I read a bunch of stuff by Chris Bacalo and always loved his artwork and just what a talent. And I may have to go back and read the first year of this book series again because I haven't thought about it in a long time. Well, thank you for that. It's a great mention for a story.
Yeah, thank you.
I picked another short story. I'm really on this kick right now with these DC Holiday Specials. The one I mentioned in the first half of the show was DC Holiday Special number 1 from 2008. I picked another story from there this time. I picked a 6-page story called A Day Without Sirens. It's written by Joe Kelly with art by Michelle Bertolorenzi. And the story is, it's obviously in Gotham, right? And it's during the holiday season, and there's this public relations campaign is advertising it as, quote, a day without sirens, end quote. So the idea is that all of Gotham crime and fear is supposed to be replaced with love for a day. You know, everyone's just, whatever, right? But the police are shocked when the campaign actually works. The phones don't ring at the police station for an entire day. There are simply no crimes reported. And after a while, the police begin to unwind. They kind of enjoy their day. They start to share meals. They listen to some music. And the best of all, they find a little bit of hope. And after exactly 24 hours of no sirens, at 12:01 a.m. the next morning, the police phone rings about a double homicide. You know, it couldn't last, but Commissioner Gordon feels hope once again. And it's an uplifting story. And then there's this final page, a surprise reveal, that Oracle has been rerouting all of the Gotham City police calls all day long, and Supergirl has been dealing with every single call. So, like, Supergirl's exhausted. And it's sort of like it's an adorable button on the end of the story, and it makes you feel good that our heroes are still trying to instill hope. So, and it sort of echoes that really well-known Christmas tale, you know, quote, the Silent Night of Batman from Batman 219 from 1970. So it's a really nice story. I'm really digging rereading these DC holiday specials from 2008 to like 2011. They're out there in DC Infinite. They're well worth it. There's a lot of great stuff in there.
This was a fun story. I forgot about this one until I read the note, but yeah, I liked this story a lot.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Now, Ryan, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit? Perhaps you could nudge Wesley Dodds to go finally buy that Christmas present for Diane. And if he doesn't, he's likely going to be in the doghouse with her, and he needs to stay on her good side, or she's never going to introduce him to her nephew Sandy, and that's kind of important.
Well, I have nowhere else to go, so yeah.
He means that literally, folks. I'm just telling you. Like, Angie wants nothing to do with him. So, now don't worry, Ryan. We will bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
Cheerscast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. Slide up to the bar alongside Ryan Daly and a rotating cast of guest hosts as they celebrate the long-running, award-winning television series, one hilarious episode at a time. New episodes of Cheerscast drop every Thursday, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
The Society Pages.
All right, folks, time for the Society Pages, which is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. And of course, the name Society Pages is taken from the letter column of the 1992 JSA series. Now, our special topic of discussion this episode, we were sharing some of our favorite holiday comics. How about you folks at home? What are some of your favorite holiday comics? And I don't mean just JSA, but any holiday comic. Would love to hear it. Let us know in the comment section on our website. Let's see. Oh, I finally got a chance to read the new Jeff Lemire JSA number 1, you know, on DC Infinite Ultra. Oh my gosh, it was so good. I loved it. There was mystery, there was intrigue, action, lots of fun, some great characterization. I am all in on this series right now, folks. I also got my Superpowers 3-pack of the JSA figures Green Lantern, Starman, and Hourman. So cool. And finally, I got lucky recently. I finally got a chance to order the larger Parabek promotional poster from the 1992 Justice Society of America series. I've always had the smaller one that was the flyer, but I finally got a chance to order the larger promo poster. I can't wait to get it. Some of you folks at home actually reached out to me about the poster as well, and I want to say thank you for thinking of me. Okay, as we get into your feedback, let me remind you, go out on the social media. You can find us on most platforms as JSA Presents, because as I always say, it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now, first up, we're going to cover some iTunes or Apple Podcast reviews. So if you haven't left a review on iTunes or Apple Podcast, please consider it. It really helps to raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. You can just look on iTunes or Apple Podcast for Justice Society Presents. And if you're outside the United States and leave us a review, please just message me. Otherwise, I won't see those reviews unless I filter to the specific country. And as a thank you, for anyone that leaves a review on iTunes or Apple Podcast, we will read that review in its entirety on the air, just like these folks. So our thanks go out to Jordan XT. Jordan writes, excellent recap of the first super team. JSA in the 90s is the podcast I never knew I needed. It's rekindled my love for the JSA. Great show format and excellent guests. Definitely worth a listen for fans of DC Comics history and the JSA. Aw, well, thank you, Jordan. That's extremely kind of you. Then we got a review from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. Bucky writes, it's time to go old school. It's time to join forces with Dr. Midnight, the Golden Age Flash, the Al Pratt Atom, and who's the mysterious stranger? Dressed in the Third Doctor cosplay with a Lone Ranger mask? Why, it's your host, Shag. Every episode, Shag and his International League of Super Guests take you through the great adventures of the original superheroes, who may be older, but they can still save the day. They just get better and better. P.S. God bless grandparents and senior citizens everywhere. I felt that needed to be there because that needed to be said. Bucky, thank you for the kind review. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Bless all the grandparents and senior citizens out there. They're incredibly valuable to the community, just like the JSA are in these comics. Then we got a review from Mr. Happy 0121, who writes, A+, really enjoying the new podcast, and please put me in the category of the longer the podcast, the better. There's no such thing as too much when it comes to the JSA. Aw, well, thank you, Mr. Happy. I'm getting a lot of positive feedback about the length. I was really concerned, but it's nice to hear the rewarding comments. So thank you, folks. Again, folks, look for Justice Society Presents on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, and please consider leaving us a review. It will really help the show. All right, time to get into your feedback from the previous episode. We have collected all those comments, put them into one big long Google Doc. It is 16 pages of feedback. You guys are amazing. So obviously I can't read every word, so I'm going to acknowledge every single person that left a comment on the website and then read a portion of their comments. The majority of the comments are coming from our website, firewaterpodcast.com/JSA, but also I'm looking at our email and our social media. Again, just pulling bits and pieces of all that to try and read on the air. We are going to be here covering our most recent episode, which was talking about Justice Society of America number 3 from 1992 with my guest, Jim Beard. First up is Al Girding, who says, love this podcast. I actually like the green cowl on Starman. There's no reason why heroes can't have a whole closet full of costume variants that they have used over the years. One of the early issues of All-Star Squadron showed all of Carter Hall's Hawkman helmets lined up. That always made me giddy. See, Al, I am so glad I'm not the only one out there that liked the green cowl on Starman. Thank you. Then Al goes on to say, costume redesign is an interesting topic. The early Hourman cowl depictions have always been yellow with black shadowing on the front. I think Perez was the first, maybe wrong, to have colored the cowl black with a yellow interior. I love that look, and that's why I like his son Rick's design many years later with the black and yellow reversed. Totally agree, Al. The reverse look that Rick wears on the cowl for Hourman just looks totally boss, so I'm right there with you. Then over my buddy Michael Bailey from the Fortress of Bailey 2, it all comes back to Superman, the Overlooked Dark Knight, and much more. Michael says, I was one of the people that went up to Jim Beard at a convention, Dragon Con a few years back, and asked if he was the one that ran that Yahoo group, which I remembered being on quite a bit back when it was a thing. So hearing him on this episode was a real treat. I loved his perspective on the story and the JSA in general, and he's a great guy to podcast with. Then Michael chimes in about the best JSA costume revamp. He says, I have to say it's the final costume of the Earth 2 Robin that he wore. Is he someone you think of when it comes to the JSA? Probably not, but he was in the JLA-JSA crossovers and the Super Squad, so that's enough for me. Hey, Mike, I'm all in on the Super Squad, so Robin being part of the JSA to me in the 70s is totally fair game. Then we heard from Joseph Blazer, who says, fun show. I remember Jim from the old comic block boards, so it was a great treat getting to hear his voice. Then Mr. Blazer goes on to take me to task. He says, I was a little peeved at the ragging on Primal Force. I count myself among the dozens of fans for William Willpower Two Trees. Keep up the good work. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Blazer. I also consider myself a big fan of Primal Force, and I have very fond memories of those earlier issues, but when I looked at issue 12 for the Kiku Thunder appearance. I was put off quite a bit by the art for that issue. So I still have a love for the concept. I have love for those early issues, but I'm sorry I let you down. They'll hear from Sean Ross from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has a show called Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast. Sean says, fantastic episode. I love the discussions of JSA legacy costumes. I know I will be in the minority in this, but I love the original Will Payton Starman costume, a.k.a. the peanut butter and jelly look. Oh, Sean, you're trying to hit all my hot buttons. I know you are. The peanut butter and jelly Starman costume, just, I can't stand it. I love the black and red costume that Will Payton wore, but that first one just drives me nuts. And you know that. You're just trying to pick at me. Anyway, Sean goes on to say, even more controversially, I love the original Rick Tyler Our Man 2 costume from Infinity Inc. Sean, you may be the only person I've ever heard say that. So, interesting. And then he says, maybe my love for Prince has impacted my fondness for purple costumes. Now that I think about it, I would love a book with all purple costume characters, which of course would be titled Purple Rain. Sean, that was a long way for a joke, man. then we hear from our buddy Symbol Pending, who runs a Power Girl blog called Symbol Pending. He says, I do actually see where Jim Beard is coming from. When Power Girl was first introduced, she was one of those loud, obnoxious characters that constantly put down their male colleagues for not giving them respect, which seemed to be the 1970s male writers thought that it was what it meant to be a feminist. Thankfully, Power Girl quickly settled down, and the costume change and Huntress arriving in the scene settled down into what I like to call her cool anti-phase. And then Symbol mentions, I only recall what Dr. Midnight's cryo whatchamacallit thing was, as I've been catching up on the very excellent Earth 2 podcast. Oh, that's fantastic, Symbol Penny. Earth 2 podcast, we're good buddies with Peter and David over there, so glad that you're catching up on their episodes. And then Symbol Penny says, the best Ultra Humanite will always be Dolores Winters. I'm not sure where my favorite Ultra Humanite is, but Dolores Winters certainly holds a certain spot in my heart, so I understand where you're coming from. Then we heard from Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as JLU Cast. He's part of the Superman Movie Minute and more. Chris says, so it's no surprise that my favorite JSA member redesign is the red, yellow, green adult Earth 2 Robin costume, particularly the version with the half cowl as seen in my favorite comic book of all time, The Brave and the Bold number 182, and the recent McFarlane Toys DC Multiverse figure. As for this series, I do like Al Pratt's design, but I like Parabek's interpretation of Our Man's cape as more of an Inverness cloak with the fabric draping his shoulders. Chris, thank you. Those were the words I was looking for. Yes, it looks like an Inverness cloak on Our Man, and I think it looks awesome. And then he says, I don't mind the green Starman cowl, especially after Tony Harris and others retcon that Ted had many variations of his costume. David was seen in the green cowl in Starman number 0, as I recall, and when he had his own cowl up in the Talking with David issues, I think they usually depicted the green cowl. So it did stick around a bit. Chris, you're warming my heart here, hearing more people cheerleading the green cowl on Starman. That is absolutely fantastic. Chris goes on to say, I like the pudgy Johnny Thunder myself, seemed to kind of fit his Mickey Rooney-like persona, since Rooney got a little thick around the middle when he got older as well. And then he says, I do see what Jim Beard's saying about the final splash reveal of Ultra Humanite. It may be the coloring, but if you look at Ultra Humanite's right hip, he looks pretty thick there. I personally miss the White Gorilla look because the Secret Society Supervillains JLA-JSA crossover is my personal favorite of the whole lot. Plus, there's a Justice League Unlimited connection. Oh, and thanks, Shag, for making the DJ Rub-A-Ducky gag. Thank you, Chris. Somebody gets my dumb jokes. So you really warmed my heart this time, buddy. I appreciate it. Then we heard from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, Dr. Midnight costume does look cool. Plus, doesn't he have a pet owl? yeah, it's a good point. He does have a pet owl. He also says, did Dr. Midnight ever team up with Captain Midnight? You know, as far as I know, he did not. And Hal chimed in later. He says, Captain Midnight is more or less in the public domain, so technically, so is Midnight, but I doubt it's worth invoking DC's ire to use him. Then we're from Jose Rivera, author of The Underground Adventures. He says, in terms of redesigns, cheers to the new look for the Ultra Humanite. It's a great middle ground between the ape and the human look, distilling it down to something familiar yet formidable. Though I'd probably throw in some Doc Savage-esque Jonder pants to complete the look. You know, hey, Jose, I'm glad I'm not the only one there liking this look for the Ultra Humanite, so thank you. But then he says, jeers to the Arctic Elf design for the Thunderbolt, as this looks less like the Thunderbolt and more like something that'd be home in a... at home in Eternia in a Filmation cartoon. This one just narrowly beats his purple look in Crisis Times 5 story in Morrison's JLA terms as of the worst look for the Thunderbolt. Glad it didn't stick. We're getting a lot of feedback, strongly feedback about the Thunderbolt look in this book. So I think we all kind of like other iterations than this version. Then M.A. Solko wrote in and says, wait, the blonde from the cliffhanger wasn't Naboo in Kent Nelson's body? I love that. And I'm so glad that someone else remembers that era, the J.M. DeMatteis era of Dr. Fate. Thank you. Then from Super Captain, it says, much to my wife's chagrin, I am not a cosplayer except for a few fun family holiday pictures when the kids were young. If I were going to cosplay, though, I would pick the original Wesley Dodd Sandman costume. And then the following year, I could walk around asking, are you my mummy? From The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances from the Christopher Eccleston series of Doctor Who. Super Captain, as a huge Doctor Who fan myself, I absolutely love that reference. Then he goes on to say, I'm not sold on the new Ultra Humanite look introduced in this issue. I prefer the big white gorilla. More monkeys are always better. I did, however, enjoy the Humanite's turn as Dolores Winters. This is Shag. Now, a lot of people miss the giant gorilla look, and I think that's pretty cool, too. But, I guess it's just me and Jose liking the new Ultra Humanite design, and that's okay. Everyone has a favorite design for something, so it all works. And then Super Captain poses a question to the group in general, so maybe somebody can help him with this. He asks, did Johnny Thunder have much interaction with the Shazam family at any point? I feel like I'm forgetting something, but if not, he seems like a good fit with the Marvels. You make a good point, Super Captain. I could totally see Johnny Thunder's sort of quirkiness fitting in with, the Uncle Marvel and all that stuff. I don't know. Anyone at home want to chime in on the comment section on our website and help them out? All right, so moving on, we heard from Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels, Monster Problems, Super Problems, and Time Problems. Jason writes, great episode. Jim Beard was a fun and knowledgeable guest. Agreed on the new Black Condor from the 1990s, thought he looked cool, and was disappointed and baffled by his way short JLA stint. And a major head scratcher is DC killing him off after years of doing nothing with him, only to almost immediately introduce another Black Condor who could have easily just been the previous one. Wasteful and puzzling, to say the least. I am right there with you. I really liked that 90s version of Black Condor. I thought there was a lot of potential there. I was looking forward to a modern-day version of the Freedom Fighters, and them killing them off is just so disappointing. So I am right there with you, Jason. Then Jason says, Shag and Jim, I feel your pain regarding your beloved JSA being brought back and canceled over and over. I'm a fan of Ted Kord, Blue Beetle, New Warriors, Monica Rambeau, Captain Marvel, Wonder Man, Mockingbird, Jack of Hearts, and Captain Atom. Not to mention lesser-known mutants like Magma, Charisse, Kylan, Skids, and Rusty Collins. I will never know peace and contentment in this life. Oh, Jason, I love it. At least you're aware of the problem. So there we go. Then we're from Matthew Davis, who says, another fun episode. And fun is the main word. I don't mind a long episode as long as it's entertaining. Aw, well, thank you, Matthew. I appreciate that. And he says, it's not so odd that Al and Ted are hanging out together. Remember, the first All-Star Squadron annual, Al and Ted were trained by the same person. Okay, that's some nice connective tissue. Thank you, Matthew. And then he says, and I like the gorilla body for Ultra Humanite. Being stuck in it adds to his bitterness. All right, another vote for the gorilla body on Ultra Humanite. So then we heard from Mark Baker Wright from Black Rock's Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. Mark writes, while I did catch most of this series when it originally came out, I definitely find that I have a better appreciation for it now, having read all of All-Star Squadron, which I hadn't heard of in the early 1990s. I share everyone's disappointment that Johnny and Libby didn't work out. But having not really known who Johnny was back then, and then coming to the relationship in All-Star Squadron, always having known how it was going to end, this issue itself didn't hit me so hard. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing Jesse again in the later issues. And then Mark says, you talked about the fact that DC made the decision to end the series very early on. It boggles the mind that editorial allowed the team to be brought back from limbo only to try and kill them off again barely a couple years later. At least some of the characters were spared and got to go on to substantial second acts, or maybe even third or fourth acts afterwards. Yeah, Mark, I totally agree with you. It, like, blows my mind. They bring the JSA back in Armageddon Inferno. Then, they give them their own series immediately. 10 months later, they cancel the series anyway. And then 2 years later, they kill them all, or not all, but they kill several of them in Zero Hour. It's just extremely disappointing that DC did that at the time. But again, as I've said on some of the previous episodes, it's horrible what happened, but it led to a lot of great content. So I'm happy with the lemonade that was made from those lemons. All right, up next is Clinton Robinson from the Coffee and Comics podcast. And I want to mention, I mentioned the story from DC Holiday Bash 2, right? Well, a couple years ago, Clinton and I covered the Kyle Rayner and Connor Hawke story on his podcast, Coffee and Comics, for part of his Christmas celebration. So if you want to hear more from this issue, go find that episode of Coffee and Comics. And Clinton says, Shang, I hate it to say it, but you neglected one of the greatest costume redesigns for Wildcat. No, not Yolanda's look in Infinity Inc. or even the Stargirl TV series. I'm talking about Ted Grant. But it's not strictly from the comics. I'm talking about the greatest iteration of Ted Grant ever, Coach Wildcat from DC Superhero Girls. Ted's rocking a sleeveless hoodie with his cat ears pulled up over his traditional mask. And while the hoodie and sweatpants is quite amazing for Ted, let's be 100% honest with ourselves. It's the coach's whistle that really pulls the entire ensemble together. Give it a look and tell me I'm wrong. And if you disagree, you better be ready to run laps. You know, it is a pretty epic look for Wildcat. I can't deny that, Clinton. So it's a great one. I love it. Thank you. Then we heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl Huntress podcast. Tim says, count me as liking Johnny Thunder putting on a little weight. It actually made sense for him as an everyman with a magic buddy. No need for him to be portrayed as buff and tough, and let's get some representation for other body types, especially for people of a certain vintage. I'm all for it. And he says, I don't think this series ever addresses how the heroes got their lives straightened out after their time in limbo. Let's see, 6 years in publication time since Crisis, which probably means 1 to 2 years in-universe, and they all probably were declared dead. Nah, does it make great stories to describe how they got undeclared? Probably not, but I can't help wondering. Yeah, Tim, I imagine it would probably be like an entire issue of just watching the JSA members in line at the DMV in the Social Security office, which I'd totally be down for reading, but yeah, probably wouldn't sell a lot of issues. Then Tim says, the first time I saw Dr. Midnight was not in a story, but on the back cover, the 1976 JLA Treasury Edition. This front cover has 8 Leaguers racing out from the center, and the back had a similar image, but with the JSA. Luckily, I found the image online, and where they had on the front Green Arrow, the back had a Dr. Midnight. Actually, this was my first introduction to the JSA, period. Well, that's awesome, Tim. Love that. Thank you for sharing. Then we're here from Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for Girl blog, and he says, what a treat to hear the nigh-legendary Jim Beard chat this issue with you. His JSA knowledge is second to none. And Jim is so right. Starman's helmet just looks wrong with a changed color. Okay, there we go. There's a vote against the Green Cowl. Oh, and Martin does this whole thing about right and wrong. This is really funny. Then he says, Jim is so wrong. I've never heard of anyone who hated the classic Power Girl. Shag is so right. Sandblast was suggested as a new hero name for Sandy Hawkins. The idea came from Wildcat in JSA number 5, along with Sandstorm. Then he says, Jim is so right. That Adam with a bald head and mustache is awful. He looks like Mr. Wilson from Dennis the Menace. I think Mike Parabek went too far in making the JSAers look old. It's no wonder that some of the DC high mucky mucks thought that that made DC's line look silly. And he says, I don't like the new Adam costume one iota. It's all kinds of dull compared to the original, which was outrageously weird, making it unique. Then he says, Jim is so right. That final page is not good at all. The fantasy creatures look stupid, even for a fantasy creature. And the entire Ultra Humanite body just looks wrong. Not just the torso, but the way the massive leg connects to the torso. Then he says, my favorite update is Mr. Terrific, from nondescript Golden Age to hottie in leather. then he says, the new Johnny Thunder lightning bolt design is horrible. Just horrible. That rug. It looks like Creeper it looks like Creeper cosplay meets Barbie. Oh, Mart, you cracked me up, man. Thank you so much for all that. Then we're from Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcast Network. Has shows like the Terminator Now podcast. And he's my co-host on the Blue Devil episodes of the Once Upon a Geek podcast. Now, Frank leaves quite a long dissertation, as usual. And it's all fantastic. And Frank has a lot to say where he's unhappy about. And one of the things he goes on about, he says, I used to have this run of this volume. And revisiting the series for this podcast, I'm reminded of why I got rid of it. I just don't like this book very much. And Len Straczynski is the problem. Now, there's a lot to read here. You should go read on the website, but he talks a lot about the pace of the story, the introduction of the characters. He talks about a lot of lack of representative for diversity. Then he goes, the art is the strongest point of the series, but I don't think Mike Macklin's inks entirely play into Parabek's strengths. Mike Parabek's style is still evolving, but there's Ordway-like feathering that doesn't quite fit. Then he says, I like seeing these characters drawn in the style now, but that wasn't at all what I wanted in 1992. As a part of the target demographic, old farts and half a century past Mystery Man fashion couldn't have been further from my four-color favors. Then he says, for costume redesigns, I like Alan Scott's Sentinel outfit and the Huntress's better suits. I gotta say, Frank, I think you and I are the only ones who like the Sentinel redesign from the 90s, but hey, you love what you love, man. Then he says, the Atom redesign is very prefab team book, very Champions. What does he owe to Ray Palmer? I prefer the kinky first outfit, from which I believe Dark Horse's even more BDSM Vigilante X was derived. Then he goes on to say, something I got sick of quickly was Geoff Johns' bloodthirsty massacres of other people's characters to set up his own, often half-baked replacements. He may have been derivative, but I don't think the Sal Velluto firebrand deserved to die in a short anthology story after a 9-issue solo run, especially since he was still a rare Latin character. I also feel targeting of the co-creator Brian Augustine, who in that same role had developed the Ryan Kendall's Black Condor across 12 issues. There's no good reason why he couldn't have been in the Palmiotti Gray Freedom Fighters, given how little impact John Trujillo, yes, I had to look that up, has had over the past 18 years. Again, another person saying how much they like the Ryan Kendall Black Condor, and it was unnecessary for him to die. So thank you, Frank. Totally agree with you there. And yeah, I agree that Geoff Johns had a bad habit of murdering characters so that he could replace him with his own. You did see that happen from time to time. So again, folks, go out and read Frank's dissertation out on the website. Then we hear from Justin Steiner from the Shoe Fly Pie Substack, who says, I want to know who these people are that are complaining about the run times. Do they want less of this podcast? Do they not understand the concept of joy? In other words, another great episode. Aw, well, thank you, Justin. I appreciate that. I'm getting a lot of positive feedback, as I said, about the length, so maybe I won't worry about it as much. Justin goes on to say, I don't know that I have a favorite costume redesign, because I often miss subtle changes. I love the black and yellow Our Man costume, or whatever variation, for instance, but I don't think I could articulate what those variations are. Hey, totally with you there, Justin. The only time I can ever figure out a costume change is if I look at like two pictures at the same time on the internet, so I totally understand where you're coming from. Then we're from Alan Williams from the Monsters from the Id blog and the Watch This Space podcast and more. Alan writes, first major post here, please don't skewer me too badly. Don't worry, Alan, we'll go gentle on you. Alan has a lot to say here, so again, I cherry-picked some of the some bits here. He says, I wasn't a big fan of when I first read this series in the 90s. Parabek's art felt cartoony, and Straczynski's writing seemed to ignore what often little personality Roy Thomas gave each character in the All-Star Squadron and Infinity Inc., and he played too fast and loose with previous continuity. I revised my opinion upward when I reread the series a few years ago. I appreciated Parabek's clean line work. Straczynski's respect for the characters is evidence, even in how he aged them to make them seniors instead of leaving them in their young and fit post-Ragnarok state. Well, I'm glad you came around to the series. We're really enjoying it. Then he says, I like Adam's costume redesign. He never needed a cape in the first place. Making Al Pratt bald with a mustache is no worse than drawing Alan Scott with a full mustache and beard. And that's a recent thing. And I'm glad you said that. Now, a lot of people don't care for Alan Scott in the mustache and beard. I don't know where you fall on that, Alan. I kind of like it. I think it's a neat look. Obviously, I like Al the way he is. So, you know, it's a different look. And I think it's just as valid. And some people like it and some people don't. Then a little later, Alan says, I always bugged me about this series. And it still does, for that matter, that we see so little of the Infinity Inc. or the JSA members who didn't go to Ragnarok. There's no mention of Sylvester Pemberton's death, and no mention of the or appearance of either Wildcat or Dr. Midnight, both of whom would be killed off about a year later. This would have been a great last hurrah moment, in addition to adding more women and ethnically diverse characters to the book. I totally agree. I mean, I get why Straczynski probably focused on the Golden Age versions of the characters just for recognizability, but you're right, there's absolutely no reason why they couldn't have brought in the younger characters. Again, throw some... they were already trying to build some diversity, clearly, by adding Kiku Thunder, by adding Jesse Quick, but you know, you have right there, as you said, the new version of Wildcat, the new version of Dr. Midnight, right there already existing, bring them in as well. Would have been a great addition to the book. So it's a shame they didn't make it in there. And who knows, maybe if they gotten past 10 issues, they would have. I'm not sure. Thanks, Alan, again, for your first comment on the website, and hope we didn't skewer you too badly. All right, then we hear from Doug Adamson from the upcoming new podcast called The Monitor Tapes, a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast that he'll be doing with our buddy DC Dave. Doug says, I enjoyed this episode and the long discussion around it. At this stage in the series, and the podcast series, I mean, I think there's not much discussion about the actual issues and more about the JSA in general. And I, for one, am all in on that approach. And look at me using current DC marketing terms. Who says advertising doesn't work? Oh, Doug. Corny. But yeah, I think it's been a great platform for us to talk about the things we care about with the JSA. Then we heard from our buddy, Dr. Chris Lewis, who's a medical doctor. This is a little long, but hey, this is great. It cracks me up. He says, on the subject of Dr. Midnight's costume, I can just imagine the incensed emails from the infection control team. They're going to have some pretty big problems with his redesigned look. The crescent moon buttons are a harbor for bacteria. And those brown leather gauntlets, please, disposable latex-free gloves, and only if the task really requires it. Otherwise, the rule is bare arms from the elbows down. And that cape is the worst trip hazard. That's got to go. So, and stay with me here, I'm proposing a Dr. Midnight costume based on Scrubs, Green is a more traditional medical color, but let us stick with the tradition and go with a red scrub top with green bottoms. A discreetly embroidered crescent moon on the breast pocket would be appropriate. He's going to need to keep that black cowl with the iconic goggles. Some doctors keep small pieces of metal equipment in a bum bag or fanny pack, so a utility belt would seem appropriate for our medical superhero, just as long as it's seamless and is made of something wipeable. Clogs are typical footwear in an operating theater, but they're not entirely practical for crime fighting, so sturdy sneakers or boots would be okay. And where, since 1941, is Charles' stethoscope? It's one bit of uniform we all doctors have, stuck in our pocket or slung around our necks. Dr. Midnight should have a really fancy one. Perhaps he could get Batman to design it for him. One more thing, showing up to work with an owl on your shoulder is definitely is definitely going to get you in trouble with a hospital HR. The psittacosis risk alone is incalculable. Sorry, Hoodie, you're going to need to stay at home. Oh my gosh, Dr. Lewis, that was freaking hilarious. So I love your medical opinion on Dr. Midnight. That's awesome. All right, then we heard from Joe X, who says, at one San Diego Comic-Con, I stopped at Mike Parabek's table in Artist Alley, and he had a bin full of pages from this series that were not selling at $10 a page. Back then, I had no interest in original art, but looking back, it's one of the few things I regret not buying. Totally understand, Joe, and wow, what an opportunity to see those original pages. So cool. Then we heard from Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast and the DCOCD podcast. He says, great episode with some fun between you and Jim. Thought I'd drop in a legacy hero I'm very fond of, Tracy 13. That is a great legacy character. I like that one, Paul. Then we heard from Brett Young from the Imaginate Design. He says, the best thing about this series is Mike Parabek drawing Dr. Midnight. That costume looks so cool with those clean and simple lines. Every image of Midnight makes me think of Parabek as channeling John Byrne. Just perfect. Then J. David Weider, who has his upcoming podcast, Justice League Legacies, he helped promote the show by saying, hot dog, a new episode of my audio comfort food is coming on Sunday. Richard Field also helped promote the show, saying, I cannot wait for this. If anyone is a comic fan, give it a listen. Then John Stibe says, I can't believe I mowed the lawn yesterday, hopefully for the last time this year. And then this shows up a day later. My timing could have been better, but this podcast couldn't be. It's so fun. Definitely worth your time and attention. Now I need to come up with some new household chores just so I can listen to it. Wait, don't tell my wife that. thanks, John. And rumor on the street is those baseboards might need dusting. Just saying, buddy. Then we're from Bruno Diaz from Uncle Bruno's Customs. He says, wow, the Jim Beard. I was a JSAA-er way back in the day. I didn't have the internet or a computer, so I'd go to my sister's house to hop on my nephew's just to go on the boards. I remember chatting there with Steve Sadowski about the jowls on Wildcat's costume. I also recall telling Mike Macklin about all the love he was getting online from the group. It was great to finally hear JSA Jim's voice after 25 years. I appreciate hearing his dissenting views because they aligned with mine. For example, Al Pratt's look, Ted's green hood, Ultra Humanite's human look. I commend him on his courage to disagree with the host. Hey, Bruno, I always invite my co-host to disagree with me. I think that actually makes a more interesting podcast if we don't agree. So I'm perfectly fine with folks coming on the show and not seeing eye to eye with me. As long as we have a good time, you know, and it makes a fun podcast, that's all that matters. Then we hear from Joey Hoffman regarding the Al Pratt costume redesign. He says, this costume was my introduction to the Atom. This was Al Pratt for me. Enjoying this discussion in the show. Well, thanks, Joey. Then Roger Pree writes in to say, I'm one days old when I found out that the robot Red Tornado was created for the JSA and not the JLA. Wow, Roger, that is shocking. I mean, you've got a pretty deep bench of comic book knowledge, I know for a fact. So I'm surprised you didn't know that he was created for the JSA. And I'm disheartened that DC has done a disservice to more recent fans by not letting them know that he was created for the JSA. So, oh, wow, shocking. Then we hear from Michael Lundholm, who says, I just got done listening to this episode. It was such a fun listen, as I'm reading through the series for the first time. Ah, Michael, I'm so glad you're reading along. That's awesome. And then we hear from Extremely Uncanny, from the Extremely Uncanny blog, who says, just finished the episode this morning, and I really enjoyed it. The discussion on costume redesign was fantastic, and I'm with Jim Beard on the underwhelming nature of the Ultra Humanites reveal. All right, that's another vote down for the Ultra Humanite. I think the Big White Ape's going to win it out, folks. Now, this is the part of the show where we thank everyone who shared the show in their social media timeline. That includes Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. It is a long list of names, I am aware. However, these folks showed their support and helped promote the show. So it's important to me that we recognize these individuals, you know, because like this is the only time I'm going to mention Brad Dade on the show. But you know what? He helped promote the show, so he's part of the family, and he deserves our thanks. So the good news is our community is growing. This time out, we got over 80 names of people who helped promote the show recently. So here's everyone who could help promote the show by sharing or retweeting or whatever the hell it's called on the other platforms. So this is Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. Our thanks go out to Al Girding, Alan Boyce Jr., Andre TFG, Andrew Redheaded Fanboy, Anthony J. Hood, Back Issue Magazine Facebook Group, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages Blog, Billy from the Bat Pod, Billy Delicious and his account for A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Brad Dade, Brian Schufo, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chuck Krieger-Loridans, Clinton Robison and his Coffee and Comics account, Craig McD, Dan Dougherty, David A. Gutierrez, David Gallagher, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank, Doug Adamson, Ed Moore and his Teal Productions account, Eddie Schmitz, Extremely Uncanny, Francisco Velasquez, Glenn Whitmore, yes, Glenn Whitmore, the colorist for the JSA series we're covering, Gord Tolton and his account for Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Gus Casals, Imaginate Design, J. David Weeder, Jim Beard, John Stibe, J.P. Roca, Justin Steiner, Keechee Baker and his account for Sports and Comics, Con L. Lemonade, love that, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Max Romero, Michael Bailey, Michael Kramer, Miracle Man, Mo Walker, Nicholas Alheim, Nuno Duarte, Otakuology Podcast, Patrick's Tactics and Tutorials, Paul Kean and his account for DC Specialcast, Pedro Angosto, Pete Flower, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Richard Field, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, Robin Hood, The Bold Outlaw, S. Matthew Stolte, Sean Drox, Sean Ross and the Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Siskoid, Slangward Scott, Stephen E. Shend, Stop, Let's Team Up, a comic podcast, Straight Out of the Federation, Symbol Pending, The Earth 2 Podcast, Tim Price, Venkman, Willie Yarbrough, Inza Morgenstar, The 108th Sage, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew! My thanks to all of you for your support of the JSA in the 90s podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, folks. I mean seriously, you guys are such a major component of why I want to do this and the interactions. It just means so much. And the community of the JSA fans we're building together is absolutely fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Jim Beard. I do my best to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they just slip through my internet fingers. So please keep those cards and letters coming. As always, the best way to be part of the discussion is on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. You can leave your comments on the show post there, and your fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts and communicate with you. You can find us on most of the social media platforms as well as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads, or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. My thanks again to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now, if you're one of the real fans who are still listening at this point, I'm going to give you a sneak preview. Next month in January, we are going to announce something pretty exciting for how we're going to help celebrate the JSA's 85th birthday next year. I'm working with, let's just say, a lot of other folks, and we've got something big planned to celebrate the JSA's 85th birthday next year in 2025. So tune in next month for details on that. See? It pays to stay around to the end of the feedback section, doesn't it? All right, now we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll see if this episode's guests, Noah Tarnow and Ryan Daly, can join us for some candy canes and eggnog.
Gathered together from the cosmic reaches of the universe are the most powerful forces of good ever assembled. The Man of Steel, the Maid of Might, the Caped Crusader, the Scarlet Speedster, the Galactic Guardian, the Last Son of Mars, the Sea King, the Emerald Archer, the Tiny Titan, and the Winged Avenger. Together they are the Justice League of America. Join me, J. David Weeder, and a roster of valiant guests as we discuss comics featuring the greatest superhero team of all time, the Justice League, on the Justice League Legacies podcast. Thrill to the team adventures, solo adventures, team-ups, crossover events, Elseworlds, and more, as they're all put on the round table for coverage. Look for it monthly, wherever you find your podcasts and at JusticeLeagueLegacies.com.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got both Noah and Ryan back with us to roast chestnuts and eat candy canes. Noah, first off, thank you so much for appearing on this episode and coming back to the show. I really appreciate it. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you on the internets?
I'm all about the Big Quiz Thing. That's my company, BigQuizThing.com. We provide the finest in corporate and private live trivia events nationwide, worldwide, in person, virtual, hybrid. Check me out at BigQuizThing.com. I am also on Blue Sky, like all the cool kids now. I'm on Instagram as The Noah Tarno. There was another Noah Tarno, so I had to become The Noah Tarno. And I host my own podcast called I Don't Get It, The Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn Cast, where a fellow late 40s curmudgeon, my buddy Bill, and I talk about things that are happening, things that are hot, and try to make sense of it. So find I Don't Get It, The Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn Cast on all your standard podcast providers.
Every time you say the name of that podcast, I crack up. I absolutely love the name of that show. Well, thank you again for being here. I really appreciate it. I've been enjoying talking with you.
I love it every time. Happy to be here, Shaq.
Now, Ryan, my thanks to you for appearing on this episode of the show. I just, again, talking about Sandman Mystery Theater, I knew I had to have you on. So thank you so much. Now, why don't you tell the people where they can find more of you on the internets?
Well, thank you, Shag, for having me on the show. This was a pleasure to talk about Sandman. You can find me, along with yourself, on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Currently, my show that I'm running right now is Cheers Cast, as you said, which is my index show of the TV show Cheers, my favorite sitcom of all time. But in relating to this episode proper, if you go back through old Fire and Water episodes, I have covered several other holiday and Christmas themed comics. I talked about a Ant-Man Christmas special. Chris Franklin and I talked about that Silent Night of the Batman on an episode of Batman Nightcast. Siskoid and I talked about a Ghost Rider and Thing Christmas issue on Marvel 2-in-1 on a FW team up recently. I've covered other lots of Christmas related things that you can find, including Christmas music, all over on episodes of Fire and Water Podcast. So
I had no idea you podcast. This is literally the first I've heard of this. Okay.
Yeah.
Again, thank you again so much for doing this, Ryan. I just loved having you on to talk about Sandman Mystery Theater.
Well, thank you very much for having me again. This was a big pleasure. I'm glad I got a chance to do it.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Ryan. And folks, that is going to do it. Now come back next episode when we return to our normal coverage and discuss Justice Society of America #4. It will be joined by another fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
I'm Noah.
And I'm Ryan.
And we're asking you to join the fight
for justice.